Okay, so we're going to finish chapter 4 tonight. Of that I am convinced. And we have a supplemental assignment before we get into chapter 5. Chapter 5 is the tough chapter. For one thing, it's too short in this scroll book. Fee spends probably two-thirds of this book is on what chapter 5 of the scroll book is. So I've borrowed some notes in your handout tonight. I've borrowed some guidelines for Fee. That's for chapter 5. But before we get to that, between chapters 4 and 5, we're going to do the 1 Corinthians outline. And one of the reasons why we're going to do this 1 Corinthians outline is not only is it good practice for you, help you with your exegesis and with your hermeneutic, but also a lot of the issues in 1 Corinthians are ones that we can use to discuss these principles and the guidelines of both Sproul and Free and Fee when we get into the cultural stuff, which is what chapter 5 is about. So we're on 4B tonight. Before we begin, does anybody have any residual questions from 4A? Anything that we talked about last week about the first five rules of interpretation that you'd like to bring up and argue about? Anything I said last week that you don't like? Besides, I picked on Mike Hendon last week, and I see he's not here tonight, so so I guess I shouldn't have done that. just teasing. Okay, so let's recap the first five rules. What is the first rule from 4A? The Bible is to be read like any other book. Okay, and the second rule is don't. There you go. Let's don't use Sproul's word there. Okay. I like read the Bible passionately or get involved when you're reading the Bible. Try to show some empathy. Put yourself in the place of some of the characters that are in there. And that's what he means. Let's don't even get the word existential in here. Okay? Okay, and the third rule is what? The narratives are interpreted by the didactic, right? And then we have several guidelines on the narratives here, and here's kind of where we camped out for a little while about, you know, not getting your doctrine from narratives, because if you do, that's when you come up with the same doctrine that the faith healers on TV come up with. And that's when I picked on Mike and said, you know, if you get your doctrine from the narrative, and I had the Greek up here that Ryan, how do you pronounce it again, Ryan? Oh, come on! We just did this before we started. Hey, Pistis, Suseso, can say, your faith has saved you or your faith has made you well, depending on how it's translated. But if you just look at any of the English translations in Luke chapter 8, at the daughter with the woman with the 12-year hemorrhage of blood that's in the middle of Jairus, that's what Jesus said, your faith has made you well. And so if you're going to take that narrative and you build your doctrine on it, then you're going to say, well, if you have enough faith, you can be healed, because she was. But we don't have that view of faith. James has gone over and over telling you that faith is a belief in a promise of God, and if he hasn't promised it, then you can't cause it to happen by faithing it. Okay? and we also talked about we could spend a whole evening on the word that's translated faith. That pistuo is the Greek word. We could spend a whole year on that word. To trust in God and to put your faith, your belief, your trust to lean on God, and it means to act. It means to act, not just to say, "Oh, I believe that." It's not just a head intellectual acceptance. It's not an intellectual assent. That's one thing faith is not. Faith is not saying, oh yeah, I know that. Oh yeah, I believe that. But it's to act upon that intellectual assent. Or it's to act upon what God has promised you. And so the narratives are interpreted by the didactic. The teaching portions are the portions that interpret the stories, and that's where your doctrine comes from. All right, what's the fourth rule? Somebody just got your book there. The implicit is to be interpreted by the explicit, but we also talk about the fact that there is a lot of information that is implicit. We use the example of the story of Ruth and how from what is implied there in the book of Ruth that Bethlehem was a pretty righteous city compared to some of the other ones because it was in the time of the judges, and we know that in the time of the judges there was no king and right, and every man did what was right in his own eyes, except in Bethlehem. We notice that in Bethlehem that they pretty much at least obeyed the law of the gleanings and the law of the levirate marriage and the kinsman redeemer and all of those particulars of the Jewish law that they still practiced in Bethlehem. And then we noted that, isn't it amazing or coincidental that God picked Bethlehem for where Jesus was to be born? Not. Okay, so the implicit is to be interpreted by the explicit, but do not neglect. So you probably can't build doctrine on implicit stuff, but there's a lot of implicit stuff that you can learn from the Bible to and from the different narratives and from the settings of the narratives. The more you study about them, the more you find out. That will aid your understanding, and that will show you little gems of insight in the things that God has brought about. And then the fifth rule is being careful with words. And I explained to you how I'm going to have to concede to Daryl because there's a word that to me just simply means something that purports to be by an individual and it's not by them, and that word is forgery, but that the current usage of that word seems to imply that it's done with malevolent intent and it's done for personal gain. And so Daryl cringes when I say that in 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, there's a forgery. And so I've agreed not to use that word anymore. There's an unauthorized edition. There's a piece in there that was added by a scribe in the 2nd or 3rd century A.D. that was not written by John. Okay? But we will no longer call that a forgery. We'll just call it an unauthorized edition. Alright. Alright, so now we get into the B section, the second five rules, and the rule number 6 talks about parallelism. And so the question, the study question then is, in what literary genre do we find parallelism? And there may be more than one. What did you say, Connie?
Poetry.
Poetry is by far the most obvious example of this. There may be more other genres that have it, but poetry, you know, just like we have in our poetry, unless you're doing free verse or blank verse, and if you're doing regular metrical poetry, we have a meter, and we also have a rhyme, you know, and the rhyme is a parallelism of sound. Okay, that's how we construct our poetry in English. But the Hebrews, they construct their poetry with a parallelism of ideas. Okay, and so they would say one sentence, and they would say another sentence that is a very closely related idea. You saw in the book there's at least three kinds of parallelism. There's the synonymous parallelism, there's the antithetical parallelism, and then there's the synthetic parallelism. And of course, the synonymous parallelism is, phrases that mean, if not exactly the same thing, they're very close. And all you got to do is think of Psalm 1. Blessed is a man who what? Walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. So you've got three phrases there that all essentially say the same thing. Yeah, there's minor differences in it, but that's an example of synonymous parallelism. There.
But they sort of remind them of one other one. It's the rock lyrics that were found in Judges 5. At her feet, he fell. At her feet, he
sank,
he fell. Where he
sank,
there he fell, dead.
Right. There you go. And I was going to, the next part of this question is this This literary genre is found in which books of the Bible? And everybody is going to say Psalms, right? Of course you are, because that's the. But it's found in, boy, a whole lot of books of the Bible, and one of the ones is Judges, right there in Judges chapter 5. When you have Deborah's song, the Song of Deborah, that is poetry, and it is parallelism. And one of the things that you find about parallelism is without even going to the antithetical and the synthetic yet, is that in parallelism, that those three or two, it's frequently just two, those two phrases that parallel each other, or the three phrases that parallel each other, those are not necessarily meant to be each one dissected and taken literally. You see, those present collectively a principle or an idea, and it's more of a general thing than it is a specific thing. Blessed is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of the sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. That doesn't just limit you to the sinners and the scornful and the ungodly. I mean, that's all one group of people that you're not really supposed to be totally involved with. Okay, now I want to be careful when I say this, because it doesn't mean that you're not to have anything to do with them, and it doesn't mean that you're not to witness to them, and it doesn't mean that you're not to associate with them at all. It just means that these aren't the people that you make your regular habit of hanging out with. These aren't the people that you choose to spend all of your free time with. Okay, and it doesn't necessarily, I mean, you got walketh, standeth, and sitteth. Okay, and I heard a sermon the other day, and some guy related this to what Peter did. He walked afar off, you know, after Jesus was captured, he walked afar off, and then he stood in the courtyard, and finally he sat down by the fire. And they said, see, he did exactly these three things that you're not supposed to do in Psalms. And it was an interesting sermon. We don't really think that was the point of what Psalms was written for, is to warn you about what Peter's going to do, you know, 600 years later. So what you have is you have a couple of parallel lines, and the antithetical will be two, they'll state the positive and the negative of something. And one of the examples that were given there is Proverbs 10:4. What does Proverbs 10:4 say? Yeah, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent is rich. Now see, this is an example of antithetical parallelism. You're talking on the one hand about a poor guy who, what's the description of his hand? Negligent. And you're talking about on the other hand, you have somebody with a diligent hand, and that makes rich, right? Okay. And then I put in my question, this also illustrates what principle of Proverbs that we've discussed previously. Elena? You look like you knew. You do know. You all know this. This is the one that caught some resistance. This is the one that some of you people kind of glared at me when I said this, but the Proverbs are not promises. Because if it's a promise, then all you have to do is work diligently and you're guaranteed to be rich. Isn't that what it says? The hand of the diligent makes rich. And so if I work diligently, I'm going to be rich. It's a promise. It says it right there in Proverbs. Not. I mean, it does say it right there in Proverbs, but it is not a promise. It is wisdom, and it is good practice, and probably the other half of it comes closer to being a promise. If you have a negligent hand, you're probably going to wind up being poor, although there are some counterexamples that people can quote. I know this lucky so-and-so who never did a lick work in his life, and look how much money he's got. You know, you will find isolated cases that even belie that as being a promise. But what it is, it's a good wisdom practice. And the example that I give from our modern day Proverbs is an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, that's not a promise either. You can't guarantee somebody if they'll eat an apple every day that they'll never have to go to the doctor. It's just a statement that says that good diet will probably give you better health than not good diet, right? In a pithy, easy-to-remember way. All right, so the next one, piece of parallelism that's discussed in the book, or that I want to bring up, is the one in Isaiah chapter 45, verses 6 and 7. This is one of those, quote, problem passages. Because if you look at this, and let me just do a little excursus here. I happen to be out this afternoon and I listened to Adventures in Odyssey. Does anybody ever listen to Adventures in Odyssey? You know, with the guy, Mr. Whitaker, and Connie and Eugene and all that. And man, this was a perfect episode because they got in there and whoever the, I don't hear it very often, but maybe it was Connie, but whoever the smart one was that always reads ahead, had when they got for the memory verse, she knew the memory verse from 4 weeks later, and it was, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven." And right after that, Witt said, "Here's permission passes, everybody, we're going to SeaWorld, and I'm going to treat." And then so they said, "Oh, Witt's rich, he can't go to heaven." And so, you know, it really was a great episode that fits right into this interpreting, you know. And the thrust of that on a child's level was you got to read the context. You got to read what the verses that come before and the verses that come after. And you can't just take one verse and use it out of context. So, but that would be a difficult passage if you took that verse out of context. All right, so the parallelism that we have in Isaiah chapter 45, verses 6 and 7. Oh, yeah, I'm not going to read mine because mine's a New American Standard and it has a better translation. Let's just read the one out of the scroll book. On the bottom of page 86, "I am the Lord and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things." Okay, so the theological question then is, God the creator of evil? Doesn't this verse just flat out say it? Doesn't this verse say God is the creator of evil? He says, "I make peace and I create evil." Well, if you don't recognize the difference in literary genres, and you don't recognize this as a parallelism, and you're hung up on a literalistic interpretation, you'd say, it says it right there in words. Book, chapter, and verse. It's book, chapter, and verse. God creates evil. All right? I got book, chapter, and verse. Okay. Beg your pardon?
Half a verse.
Yeah, we don't even need a whole verse for that. All right. So, what does he really mean in this? What does Sproul say he means in the ensuing discussion? Right. And that's exactly how the New American Standard Version, which I have, translates it. He says, "I am the Lord and there is no other, the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things." Okay? Now we can see that as a parallelism thing and the use of parallelism when the author of Isaiah here wrote that to describe God. And so we know that we have to be real careful when you're looking at poetic language, being real careful about taking the exact connotation of what that word means to you and applying it and say, "But the scripture says that." And that's in the stuff that we covered back in chapter 3 on the different parts of speech, the hyperbole, and I told you a few that weren't in the book. Does anybody remember what a synecdoche is? The part that represents the whole. Remember I said how many head of cattle you have? Do you have the rest of them too? Or do you just have a head? You know? So, you know, a synecdoche is the part that represents the whole, or vice versa, a whole representing the part. You know, you're sitting there speeding down the highway and you see the blue lights behind you and you say, "Uh-oh, here comes the law." Well, it's not the law. It's a policeman, right? But you're using the whole in this case to represent the part. And that's what a synecdoche is. So, and we talk about... And that's just, that's one of the things, the metaphors and the similes and the hyperboles and the synecdoches and did I mention Hendiades? Okay. I mean, as long as we're chasing a bunny rabbit here, I've got to remember Hendiades. You know Hendiades as well, Connie? Okay. Hendiades is when, you know Hendiades. Okay. Okay, spell it like Hendiatus. Okay. H-E-N-D-I-A-D-Y-S. And I may have the I and the Y swapped, but I think it's H-E-N-D-I-A-D-Y-S. Hendiades. Now, Hendiades is when you have two words that are connected by a conjunction, but they're not really equal. The one word modifies the other. And the very best example I can give you is a phrase that we use all the time. You say, I'll get around to that when I'm good and ready. Okay? Now, you don't mean when I'm good and when I'm ready. You mean when I am well prepared. Okay? The good modifies the ready in this case, although it's put as good and ready. And that's the key to interpreting some difficult passages as well, is that, hey, this might be a Hendiades. It says, I do not allow this and this. But what it really means is I do not allow this modifying that, because it's a Hendiades. And so all of these different parts of speech, and some of them are in the antithetical parallelism. Okay? All right, so the next question then, is what does peace mean in the Hebrew benediction of Numbers 6, 24 through 26? All right, so somebody's going to look up Numbers 6, 24 to 26. Let me know when you've got it, and I'll bring the mic so you can read it, and it'll show up on the thing. This is a familiar benediction. You've all heard this. Daryl, you got it? Okay, you've got it in the book there?
Yeah.
Go ahead and read it.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine on you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up His covenant countenance on you.
And?
That's all I got.
And give you peace? It's not in there?
No.
Well, yeah, the Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. Okay, so what does peace mean in this particular context? Does it mean absence of war? Calmness, contentment, serenity?
Comfort.
Yeah, it's a different thing. It's kind of like, if you back up to the one we had from Isaiah, where he said, I create peace, or I create peace and create evil. Okay, in that one, peace didn't actually mean absence of war either. And so we have this word peace, and this is really the previous rule that we're reiterating here. We have this word peace that doesn't always mean the same thing. Okay, it has a lot of different meanings. And so you have to be real careful with the meanings of words. My peace I give you, not as the world gives, give I unto you. My peace I leave with you, let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. What does Jesus mean there when he says, my peace I leave with you? Yeah, might be. He said, I'm going to send you a comforter, right? But he doesn't mean the absence of war. So if your definition of the word peace means the absence of war, then your definition of peace is too narrow. That's what I'm trying to say. And is that very frequently we all have these ideas in our mind of what a word means, or it means only one thing to us, and that's what it means. And when we read this passage in the Bible, we put that meaning of the word in there, and we miss the point exactly. And I'm going to reread. I read this once. I'm going to reread this. This ought to be a quote from the fee book. If you have a fee book, this is on page 210. Whenever one takes even a part of a piece of literature and uses it wrongly, that literature will be unable to do what it was intended to do, and so God's purpose in inspiring it was thwarted. Okay? So when you misread the portion or you read into it a certain meaning, you're not only just missing the boat, you're actually thwarting the inspiration of God. You're missing the boat in a big way. God has something to say to you there, and you're not getting it at all. You know, that's it's just a one of the positions that or one of the, I might have lost for words. That doesn't happen too often. It's one of the things that we should really guard against and avoid. Okay, what about answering a fool according to his folly? Proverbs 26, 4, and 5. Somebody got that? Who's got Proverbs 26, 4, and 5? Cameron's got it.
26, verse 45.
Verse 4 and 5.
Oh.
Start there and read 2, 4.
Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes.
All right, which is it? Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or answer a fool according to his folly? Okay, so you can see right there that you know, if you just read the words and you put a wooden literal meaning to it, then, well, we've got a contradiction right here in the Bible. The Bible contradicts itself. How can you read that stuff? Man, it's just so full of contradictions. How can you read the Bible? You know? Well, obviously, we go back to which one of the principles? Whenever you deal... Yeah. What's the first principle? Yeah, sort of, yeah. The analogy of faith, right? The analogy of faith, God doesn't contradict Himself, right? And so when you see an apparent contradiction here, then by the analogy of faith, you know that it's not the Bible that's contradicting itself, it's your understanding of it. It's your understanding that is flawed. And so what He's saying here is that there are sometimes in your life when you don't want to get on the same level with a fool and you don't want to discuss things on his level. You know, what's the story about don't wrestle with the pig, right? Because the pig enjoys it and you just get all muddy, you know, whatever it is. You know? Right? So there are some times when you don't want to get with the fool because it's not really going to do any good and it's just going to tarnish your witness and whatever. And there are other times when you have to start where the fool is and you have to see, you know, Paul says he became all things to all people by some hope that he might win some, right? That's what Paul says. And so there are times when you might have to, when somebody asks you a question which may seem like a foolish question, don't blow them off and say, "Oh, you fool," or "What a foolish question." You might have to say, "Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. Let me see if I can approach it this way, or let me share some thoughts that I have on you," and you may be able to bring them along into a greater understanding. And so it's really interesting that Solomon would take those two verses and juxtapose them right next to each other in the book, but it illustrates this principle that you know, the first time you're reading it, and I'm not deviating from rule number one, which is read it like any other book. Okay, if you read any other book and you saw a contradiction in it, your first reaction should not be, "Well, this author is dumb." Right? Your first reaction should be, "It's something I'm not getting here." You know, that's just the common courtesy that you would give to a human author, much less a divine author. All right, so what is the difference then between apodictic law and casuistic law? Yeah, which one's which? Yeah, the apodictic law is the thou shalt not, right? Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. It's an absolute law, you just don't do it. The casuistic law, and the way I remember it, is the first three letters of that are CAS, and you stick an E on the end, it's case law. Okay? If you see your neighbor's ox in a ditch, then you do this. Or if you should happen to accidentally kill your neighbor's goat, then you have to return to him four of yours, or whatever. You know, the different cases are there. They're the if-then, they're the conditional, as Joshua said. And in the casuistic law, they don't necessarily state every single case, right? They state a few cases, and from these, you are supposed to generalize, okay, in the casuistic law. So, for example, if it says, if your daughter, let's not do daughter, let's do if your ox. If, you know, if you destroy your neighbor's ox, then you have to return to him one of your own. For example, well, that same law would hold for his goat or his chicken or any other animal, even though it's not stated specifically for every animal. It's the same principle. You gather a principle from the law and you apply it in the casuistic law. Whereas the apodictic law does not lend itself to extended application. Its focus is on what it is. Okay? Now, there are some times when you can use extended application, and this is one of the topics we'll get into in chapter 5. But that's just the basic principle between apodictic law and casuistic law. Okay, the next question, in what two ways can the law be distorted? And what are the practitioners of these two ways called? The first part of the question is obviously more important. I happen to like to remember the names of things, and so I put that down there too. But in what two ways can you break the law? Actually, I don't know that I'd put that's a very serious issue, and I don't know that we ought to break the law. I mean, this is okay. Anybody else have an opinion? I'd like to come back to that later, Connie, but that's not the area that we're discussing right at the moment. The spirit and the letter. Right. You can break the spirit of the law, or you can break the letter of the law. The people that break, or the people that are concerned about whether or not you break the letter of the law, are called what? Legalists. Exactly. What was it that Jesus said to the Pharisees? I mean, he said a lot of things to the Pharisees. All right. But let me rephrase the question. Maybe this will jog your memory. You know, I have a lot of people tell me that you know, tithing is an Old Testament concept, that tithing is not mentioned at all in the New Testament. I say, you're wrong. Tithing is very much mentioned in the New Testament. Okay, in the place where tithing is mentioned in the New Testament, what does Jesus say to the Pharisees? Right. You tithe. You got mint plants growing out your back door, and you use some of the leaves in your iced tea, you know? And for every 10 of those leaves that you pick for your iced tea, you take one of those leaves and you put it aside, and come the Sabbath, you take that to the temple and you tie those mint leaves. Or if you get peppercorns, you count out 10 peppercorns, 9 for you and 1 for the Lord. 9 for you and 1 for the Lord. Okay? And he said, you tithe, and okay, so I'm taking a few liberties with exactly what spices they are, but it's the same concept. That's what Jesus said, is you are so meticulous about your legalism, you are so meticulous about doing that, you break the spirit of the law. You neglect the weightier matters. What are the weightier matters of the law? What is Jesus talking about when he says the weightier matters of the law? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Alright? These are the weightier. On this hang all the law and the prophets. And so, if you're ignoring God, or if you're indifferent to your neighbor, then you are breaking the spirit of the law there. It doesn't care how many peppercorns you count out. Okay, so you're a legalist. What about the other side of the coin? What do we call a person who breaks the spirit, who breaks the letter of the law, while saying, well, I'm keeping the spirit of the law? I almost don't want to go here, but right here on Manchac Road, the speed limit is what?
40 or 45.
Depending on where you are, there is a place where it's actually 55 on Manchac Road, right? What do you call a person who goes 58 miles an hour on that section of Manchac Road? A speeder! That's right! Oh, but it's only 58, you know? It's close. It's probably within the margin of error of the guy's speed gun. He's not going to get me. Everybody else is doing it. Alright? There are laws. And to obviate the law and say, well, I don't really have to do that. You know, I'm in with the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law out there on Manchac Highway is to keep excessive speed down so as to protect people. And 58 is surely close enough to do that. You know? So a person who thinks that they are not subject to the letter of the law, it's called an antinomian. Okay? So you have a legalist and you have an antinomian. An antinomian means against the law. That's anti means against, and nomos is Greek for law. So an antinomian. And Paul was accused of being an antinomian. You know? He was accused because he said, you know, you guys that weren't born Jewish, you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to be circumcised at all. You can accept Jesus without being circumcised. And so the Judaizers came along and they accused Paul of being an antinomian. But he wasn't really. Because they weren't Jews. So why should they obey the Jewish law if they're not Jews? They're not subject to the Jewish law. Okay, that's our understanding of it. Their understanding was that in order to be a Christian, you had to be a Jew first. And so you can't be a Christian by bypassing that first step, becoming a Jew. Okay, and we could get into this in a whole lot. But then you have the legalists and the antinomians, and they're two opposite ends of the same spectrum, and they're both lawbreakers. Okay, both the antinomians and the legalists. If the legalist, a legalist, if he obeys the spirit of the law as well, would not be considered a lawbreaker, but most of them don't. They're only concerned with the letter of the law. That's why he's a legalist. He's concerned with doing exactly what it says and no more. How many of you are tellers in here? Okay, well, I'm not going to embarrass a teller and ask, but I'll bet you that you get some checks sometimes from members that are $327.42 or some, you know, it's down to the penny on that check. You know, this person's a tither. And you can tell exactly what they make. Because it's exactly one-tenth the end. That's an example of a legalist, okay? A legalist is the person that the teller can tell his salary because they tithe exactly what one-tenth of what... I mean, that's what I'm supposed to give is one-tenth. You know, by George, that's all I'm going to give is one-tenth, you know? And so I made $4,982.16 this time, so I'm going to write my check for $492 and X number of cents, you know? Yeah, you know, that's a good question. Do you round or truncate, you know? You're going to have to ask a legalist that. I would bet you that most of them would round up to the next penny. Because a legalist wants to make absolutely certain that they do not fall short of the law in any one way. So, I would bet that they would round up to the next penny. That would be my guess. Alright, so we've got legalists and antinomians. Alright. What? Yeah, I know. Alright, so in Matthew 5, you know, when Jesus says, you know, you've heard it said that thou shalt not murder, but I say to you that man hates his brother is in danger of the judgment, and he calls his brother a fool is in danger. And he gives three parallelisms there, right? Increasing parallelisms, and I can't quote it exactly. And he does the same thing for commit adultery and lusting, and we all remember Jimmy Carter's famous statement, right? You know, that's, some of you are looking at me like you don't remember Jimmy Carter's famous statement. And Jimmy Carter was interviewed by Playboy magazine, okay? And so they asked, Jimmy Carter was one of the most moral presidents we've ever had, okay? I didn't think much of the guy's foreign policy, but he was a very moral man.
Or his economic policy.
I don't want to get into politics here, but he was a very moral man. And yet, he allowed Playboy magazine to interview him, and they asked him one time about sexual sins, and he said, well, I have lusted after a woman in my heart. Okay? And so that was him being straight up and honest and answering that question. And of course, if you lived through that era, it was headline news for days and days, you know. And you know, something, a chink in Jimmy Carter's armor, whatever it is, or in his morality. But the question that I have for you is, when Jesus makes this teaching in Matthew, is he saying that lust is every bit as serious an offense as actually committing adultery? And is he saying that being angry with your brother is every bit a serious offense as committing murder? Is that what Jesus is saying in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount? And I see most of you shaking your heads this way, which is in our culture means no. Well, you have to specify. I'll do a little aside on that in a minute. But you're exactly right. He is not equating it. They are not as serious, okay? What is he saying? It's still sin. And so if you look at it from the viewpoint of would that sin keep you out of heaven and without the blood of Jesus Christ? The answer is yes. Either one of those, whether you do the lust or do the actually do the adultery, either one of those without the blood of Christ would keep you out of heaven. Of course, the flip side is that neither one of those with the blood of Christ will keep you out of heaven. Okay, because of the gracious God that we have. What he's saying is, on the one hand, you've got the letter of the law, which is do not do this, and on the other hand, you've got the spirit of the law. And if you, in your mind, wish you could do the letter of the law, but that's what's constraining you, then you are breaking the spirit of the law. And of course, there's more dire consequences to actually doing the act rather than contemplating it. But this is one thing you got to understand here. He nowhere in there says that they are of equal measure. And we could get into a whole other topic there. Are there degrees of punishment in hell? And I think the Bible clearly teaches that there are. Okay. But that's a topic for another day. Okay. Regarding Jesus' statement in Matthew 5:17-19 about not abolishing the law, are we breaking the fourth commandment when we worship on Sunday instead of Saturday? Why? Justify your position. Yes, but he said, I have come not to abolish the law, not one jot or not one tittle shall I change in the law. And the law is primarily the Ten Commandments. All of that other 618 things that the Pharisees added is extraneous stuff. But the Ten Commandments, that's the law. And the fourth commandment says, remember what? The Sabbath day and keep it holy. And what is the Sabbath day? Oh, you're an antinomian. We get to do away with the fourth commandment, huh? see how important it is to have labels? By the way, I happen to agree with you. I mean, obviously, I come here on Sunday. I'm not a Seventh-day Adventist. But I'll tell you what, the Seventh-day Adventists will camp out on that, and they will tell you you're breaking the fourth commandment because you don't worship on the Sabbath. And so my question to them gets along the lines of, well, how do you know that we've kept a perfect multiple of seven over the last 4,000 years? As a matter of fact, has anybody ever go to your Unix system and type in calendar? Is it 952? It's 952, I believe. In the year 952, type in Cal on your Unix system, Cal 952, and look at the month of September. How many days are in the month of September in 952? It's like 12 days. That's the length of September. Because we went from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar or something else, and things didn't line up, and they had to make an adjustment. And so it was in the year 952 A.D., you've got some days there. And so I say, how do you know that the seventh day, I mean, you're going to trace it all the way back to the creation. How can you do that? How can document for me how you can trace back so that you know that this is exactly the seventh day? Okay? It's in our week, Sunday is the first day of the week, and Saturday is the seventh. But that's how we define the week. What if Monday was the first day of the week and Sunday was the seventh? Matter of fact, in my definition of the week, that's how it works. And therefore, I don't break the fourth commandment. No, okay. So, touche, yeah.
Business calendar starts on Monday.
Yeah.
Saturday and Sunday are at the end.
Yeah, well, there you go. See? It's already been done. James.
John, as long as you take a nap on one of those 2 days, which is the spirit of the law.
Yeah, but we're talking about the letter of the law. You know, you can't be an antinomian. All right. You know, there's all kinds of philosophical answers for that. The Lord rose on the first day of the week, and that is essentially why we've changed our worship. But, the real long and the short of it is, the fourth commandment doesn't say that you should worship necessarily on the Sabbath. It says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And you know what? I think you should keep all seven of them holy.
Amen.
All right? And if you do that, then you've got no problem of violating the fourth commandment. You know, if every day, if you spend every day glorifying God your Maker, then you got no problem with the fourth commandment. Okay. Why did Jesus teach in parables? And how does a parable differ from an allegory? This will be the last question we'll have time for tonight. Because I'm too long-winded and I chase too many rabbits. Yeah. So, you know, we discussed this a little bit this morning in the Sunday school class. Darryl, what were you going to say? Leslie said he taught in parables so that people would not understand. What were you going to say, Darryl?
He might have been teaching, so he's concealing something, maybe. But parables are easy to understand.
Parables are easy to understand, Darryl makes the statement. Does that statement stand alone, or do you need to add a qualifier to that? Say it again, Elena. Okay, you've redeemed yourself. There you go. All right. He that hath an ear, let him hear. If you are in tune with God's Spirit, then the parables are fairly easy to understand. If you are not in tune with God's Spirit, then you're like the people that God told Isaiah, keep on saying this. People keep on listening but do not understand. Keep on looking but do not see. You know? If you don't get it, then you're not going to get it. Okay? Some of the parables are a little more difficult or would be for at least Jesus had to explain in one of his first parables, the parable of the soils. Sometimes you call that the parable of the sower, but if you look at his explanation of it, it's a parable of the soils. Okay? All right, so what is the difference between a parable and an allegory? Okay, let me make this pretty simple for you. Basically, the difference is in a parable, there's one central meaning. Okay? Now, it's hard to say this because when Jesus explained this parable of the soils, he treated it more like an allegory than a parable. because he had different meanings for the different soils. But in parables, there's one central meaning. And in allegories, everything symbolically represents something else. Okay? Now, this doesn't mean that this isn't a hard and fast rule. This is a general guideline. If you find the main central meaning of the parable, you're doing very well. And, if you want to look further, you might find some other things, but if you get too involved trying to make it an allegory, then you wind up with the parable saying a lot of things that they were not intended to say. Okay? And we asked this the first night, one of the early nights, what is the main point of the parable of the prodigal son? The love of the father. That is the point. Remember, God is the hero, not only of every narrative, but of the parables as well. The love of the father, that's the point of the whole story of the prodigal son. The point's not how to waste your money. We seem to do pretty well at that without any biblical teaching, you know. The whole point of the parable of the prodigal son is the father's love. Well, we've come to the end of our time again. Well, I really want to discuss chapter 11. Question 11 and question 12, and we'll do those next week, and then we're going to get right into the outline on 1 Corinthians. And I just want to say a few words about that. You know, this is a pretty heavy assignment, the outline on 1 Corinthians. But you can do this, and it's important that you do this for several reasons, one of which is, after you finish this, you'll know more about 1 Corinthians than you ever knew before. Okay, that's one reason. Another reason is that when we get into chapter 5 on culture and cultural differences, I don't know what percentage, but an incredibly high percentage of these issues come out of 1 Corinthians. Okay? And so if you do this exercise ahead of time, then you will better be able to understand when we discuss and say, hey, women, how come you don't have your head covered? You know? Cameron, it says their hair is their covering. All right. Well, we'll discuss that when we do the deal on 1 Corinthians, and we'll do further discussion when we get into the deal on culture. And the question, I still want to remind you of this question: does the Bible endorse slavery? And you're not to answer that tonight, but I just want you to remember that that's a fundamental question that kind of steers your mind towards what we're going to talk about when we start talking about culture.